to Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday and Sunday right here on KTEP. Good afternoon. I'm Louis Sines, your host for Perspectives, and joining us today is Dr. Carl Hart. Dr. Hart is a neuroscientist, and he is the first African-American tenured professor at Columbia University. He was here for a conference recently talking about Hispanics and substance abuse. The name of his book is High Price, A Neuroscientist's Journey of Self-Discovery That Challenges Everything You Know About Drugs and Society. Dr. Hart, Carl, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Thank you for having me, Louie. Appreciate it.
Now, let's talk first about the book. People who pick up this book and who might be neuroscientists or scientists, they want to get to the nitty-gritty right away, but you start off in a very personal way. You start off from you being a little boy and you're playing with your sisters, and then something tragic happens because of domestic abuse. But what made you decide to start that way? Is that a way to kind of lure the reader in? Because it didn't me.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, if you talk about scientists, they want to get to the nitty-gritty and want to know about the data. The book is not written for scientists. The book is written for people like you, regular people, the public, the book-reading public.
It's very easy to read.
Yeah, and I wanted to make sure that it was engaging. I told an interesting story, obviously a deeply personal story. And when you do such a thing, you can't do it frivolously. And so I was worried about that. But I also knew that people learn by examples, and they tend to be plugged in based on those examples. And I tried to make sure that I had something interesting to read and say.
One of the things that we hear a lot is, like father, like son, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And at one point, your grandmama says something to you about, you're just like your dad. How did that make you feel?
Well, I mean, so you have to contextualize that. That was my maternal grandmother.
Right.
That maternal grandmother was not happy with my father because of the friction between him and my mother. And that's understandable. She wasn't happy with her son-in-law.
Serious.
Right, right. Her son-in-law, who she saw as not being good enough for a variety of reasons. And so, obviously, it was an insult. It was the comment coming from her was an insult. And I felt just like anybody else who would. I mean, I was a kid being insulted. It was not nice.
But you were trying your best to be the best that you could be.
Yeah, sure. That's exactly right. And that's why it was so hurtful. Particularly, you have a grandparent, an adult, who somebody you looked up to, and they say these kinds of things. But yeah, that's why I told these stories, because I don't think it's me alone. I think a number of people go through these sorts of things. So the question becomes, okay, how do you deal with it? What do you do?
And you and I on the drive over here, we were talking about stereotypes. And of course, there are stereotypes, a lot of them, for not just minorities, but people who live like in Hell's Kitchen, in the Bronx, in Brooklyn. And the fact that you were able to overcome a lot of those obstacles and yet go into academia, some people are going, how did he do that?
Yeah, and some people, so I think I'd like to be clear here that when we're talking about this, you and I'm talking about minorities specifically. I mean, everybody has their cross to bear, no matter who you are. But in our country, in the U.S., particularly if you are black and brown, certain types of brown, right, Mexican and so forth and black, that's not good. You have additional crosses to bear. So when you think of that, how does one overcome that sort of thing? I'm not an exception. There were a number of things that helped me along. I had mentors. I had, for example, our U.S. government had programs that helped poor families like mine, welfare, aid to families with dependent children, it was called, until 1996 when Clinton made sure that was no longer there. Ronald Reagan also gutted a number of these programs that were there to help poor families get out of those conditions. The country was in no mood to really support those programs after I became an adult, even though most of the people who were benefited from those programs are now taxpaying citizens and contributing a lot more to the general economy than we actually got from programs like welfare. And so were not for those programs, it would have been extremely difficult. There were a number of other things. There were people didn't, when it came to test scores to get into college, I went to the Air Force. I wasn't required to take the SATs because I was in the Air Force. Graduate school, the GREs, the General Record Examination, the entrance sort of exam, my scores were awful. But there were people who looked at me as a complete person as opposed to just my score. So a variety of things helped in our society that are not so much available today to people in the same situation. So the likelihood of them making it to where I am at is a lot lower because our society made some decisions and we decided that those people, poor people, they're not as valued. That's precisely what we did. But we pretend that we don't do that.
And we're talking about scores, and I'm sure a lot of people say, well, yeah, he went to college and he majored in education or he majored in sports and he's a coach. No, you're a neuroscientist. I mean, this is not easy. This is not something that you just look at and go, okay, I can do that. But one of the things that, again, stereotype, people don't talk about until recently. There's a book that just came out called Dr. Feelgood about Dr. Jacobson up in New York. And he was injecting President Kennedy, allegedly, and some big stars, all big names, with methamphetamines to keep them going. And in your book, you mention that that is one of the things that the military has been using in the past, even since World War II, and Hitler used them on his army to make them more aggressive and to keep them alert and to keep them awake.
Well, amphetamines are not used to make people more aggressive. They are used to make people more vigilant and awake and alert. As you point out, our U.S. military still uses amphetamine today, as well they should. Amphetamines are excellent for keeping people awake when they should be asleep, when you have to work during periods of long shifts. Airline pilots, I'm sure many of them take amphetamines. Taking at the right doses, they can be extremely effective. Athletes, Andre Agassi wrote a book, and he talked about his methamphetamine use. But the thing was, his interpretation were warped. He was talking about how horrible the drug was, but yet he was winning major national and international tournaments. So it's like, but we vilify these drugs when, in fact, they could be used safely, and they have been used safely.
For the benefit of our listeners, can you give us a difference between amphetamines and methamphetamine?
The difference between amphetamine we think of as Adderall, the ADHD, attention deficit disorder medication that many people are prescribed. And methamphetamine is the same drug, but it has a methyl group attached to it. The methyl group is said to make it more lipid soluble, cross the blood-brain barrier more effectively, so it makes it a little more potent is what people said. Now, we've done studies where we compare both of the drugs in the same people under double-blind conditions. I'm here to tell you, they're the same drug in humans. Methamphetamine is the same drug as Adderall. So when people who are taking Adderall or people in this country are vilifying methamphetamine users, it's the same drug.
I'm glad you mentioned that about ADD and attention deficit disorder. The fact that you did a study and you showed that some of the people who were legally prescribed these tended to have less addictive issues.
Yeah, so I didn't do the study. Other people have done that study, but I certainly cite that study. If people have ADHD and they are treated with these medications like Adderall, they are far less likely to become a drug addict or to be addicted than people who were not treated. And so at some level, the medication is protective. That's not ground shaking or earth shattering. The thing is that if people have a disorder, you want to make sure they get the proper treatment. That's what that says.
Tell us about, and this is something that you started at the beginning of your book, and that's the dopamine hypothesis.
Yeah, so we think about, many of us know what dopamine is in part because it's become so popular. It's become part of the popular lexicon. Dopamine is associated with reward. We think of that as being the pleasure neurotransmitter. It's a neurotransmitter. Neurotransmitters are how nerve cells communicate. Without neurotransmitters, I wouldn't be able to talk. Without neurotransmitters, we wouldn't be able to move. So they allow these nerve cells to talk to each other. The communication of nerve cells provides human behavior, basically. Now, dopamine, when that one is released or activated, we tend to think of it as being playing a role in pleasure. And that's an overly simplistic view, but that's the view that we've kind of marketed to the public. And that's the view in which I was trained under. And as I went along my journey, it became obviously clear to me that that's an overly simplistic view and it needed to be broadened. When we came up with our theory about pleasure, mood, and dopamine, at the time in the 1960s or so, we had about 5 or 6 neurotransmitters that we knew of. Today, we have more than 100, and that theory has not been appreciably updated. So to include all of this new knowledge that we now have, it just hasn't been updated. And so a major point is that dopamine is not only involved in pleasure, it's also released when you are stressed, anxious, and those sorts of things.
We've heard about people who suffer, like myself, chronic pain. And apparently when people are stressed out, that pain increases because that dopamine is released. And then there are ways to block dopamine that you all have done research on. But there's research in the book cited saying that some drugs increase dopamine neurons more than these pleasures, that some of these pleasures like sex and other things.
Yeah, I think that's more of the dogma. I don't know if that's the reality. When we think about sex, we think about all these other pleasurable things. People have suggested that drugs hijack the brain reward system. I don't know if that's true because you think about people, a number of people who engage in drug-taking behavior do so in order to enhance the ultimate reward, which is sexual sort of euphoria or orgasm. And I still am not sure if drugs rival that sort of peak of the sexual orgasm. I'm not sure. The verdict is out for me on that.
What about the example that you use about some of these people who were offered alternatives, money, and they took the alternative? And it shows that some people, if you offer them alternatives, they will go that way.
Yeah, I think we should take a step back. So when I started thinking about those kind of studies, I was told that these drugs are so powerfully addictive that laboratory animals, if you allowed them to press a lever to receive intravenous injections of a drug, they would do so until they died. So you allowed them to self-administer cocaine, methamphetamine. They would self-administer those drugs until they die. And it's true. When you look at the evidence, that's what happened. And so it was taken as evidence that these things are so powerfully addictive that animals kill themselves. But when you look more carefully, you see that the only option that the animal had in the cage was that lever. So they could only press the lever. Of course they're going to press the lever if that's the only thing they could do. But when you provide alternatives, sweet treat, a sexually receptive mate, other things, the animals don't press the lever until they die. In fact, they engage in those other behaviors more oftentimes than the actual drug-taking behavior under some conditions. So we did a study with humans and tried to do the same thing with crack cocaine addicts, where we offered them a choice. And sure enough, they behaved just like the animals in that if you provided them with $5, they take the drug on by habit of occasion and the money on the other half. But if you increase the amount of money to $20 or something like that, you can decrease drug-taking behavior completely. And so it told us that these alternatives are important, alternative reinforcers. That's what we have normally in our environment. So whether you're a drug user, drug addict, or what have you, if you have the appropriate alternative reinforcers, you'll engage in that alternative behavior. We've known this for some time, but it's not the most sexy thing in science because we never said anything about which part of the brain lights up when this happens. And if you're not talking about what part of the brain is lighting up, people are less interested in the 21st century.
We are social animals by trade, behavior, whatever you want to call it. And I was surprised, I didn't know this, but the rats are also social animals. And so my thinking is, okay, the rats were going and they were pulling this lever. Is it because they were bored, because they had nothing else to do? Because you cite in your book also when you talk about the fact that if someone is alone 24/7 with nothing else to do, of course they're going to go to the...
That's exactly right. Rats are social animals. And if you put another rat in the cage, it's difficult to get them to self-administer the cocaine or methamphetamine or whatever. That's right. They're just like us in that respect. Very sociable.
Now, what about the nicotine factor? Because I was fascinated by the fact that nicotine was mopping up dopamine in the brain while Coke was doing just the opposite.
Yeah, so that's one effect of the drugs, right? So one of the things that we had said was that all drugs cause this increase in dopamine activity in this brain region called the nucleus accumbens. We think it's important for reward. Now, cocaine was doing it by blocking cocaine from by blocking dopamine from being taken back up into the cell, whereas nicotine was facilitating dopamine going back into the cell. And so they were just having the opposite effect on how they were doing this with dopamine, but ultimately they both increased dopamine activity. That's not surprising so much. I mean, they are different drugs. They have a different chemical structure. The thing that was surprising is that people were saying that they were acting exactly the same on the sort of dopamine uptake mechanism. And that wasn't true. So drugs act differently in some areas. In some areas, they have overlapping effects.
We hear about people having different metabolisms and that they work differently in different people. So my wonder is, the drugs do the same thing. And you mentioned in your book that the quickest way, of course, is for the drug to get into the blood. And because of that, some people will skip a meal or not eat because they want what they call the first-pass metabolism.
Well, all right, there are a number of things here. So when we think about taking a drug orally, like alcohol, we take that orally. It goes in the stomach versus esophagus, the stomach, and then it has to be moved out of the stomach to get into the small intestines where it gains access to the blood. Now, during that whole process, it also passes through the liver, and the liver specializes in breaking down drugs. So when you take a drug orally, much of it will be broken down by the liver due to this first-pass metabolism. Metabolism means breaking it down. But when you shoot a drug intravenously, it bypasses this first-pass metabolism and goes straight from the blood to the brain. The same is true when you smoke a drug, straight from the lung to the blood and brain. That's what happens. And so it's important for people to understand that taking a drug by different routes of administration alters the onset of the effect. When you smoke it or shoot it intravenously, the onset of effects are more rapid than when you take it orally. And when you take a drug orally versus intravenous or smoked, the onset of effects are delayed.
We hear a lot of people, the fact that say, and for the example, legalization of marijuana, that's been talking a lot about, and medicinal marijuana. And some people will say, well, you know, if you have people stoned, they're going to get violent, they're going to do this, they're going to do that. One of the examples that you use is that drugs do not cause violence as much as the gangsters, Bugs Malone, Al Capone, all those people killed each other because they were drunk.
Well, I don't want to vilify alcohol, because most of the people who use alcohol do so without getting in violence and that sort of thing. But when we think about drugs and violence, people oftentimes conflate the drug business, for example, with drug direct effects of the drug. Whenever you have new drug markets or any new illicit markets, you will have some increase in violence in order to control those markets. But once those markets are matured and stable, the violence will decrease because there's less disputes. That's where we see the violence with drugs. Certainly, like, drugs themselves don't cause violence. I mean, the drug that causes the most amount of violence, we kind of know it, and that's alcohol. But most of us who engage in alcohol drinking behavior don't engage in violence. So people need to understand the difference between drug markets and drug effects.
So the example that you use from the 1920s prohibition, Al Capone was not shooting down Machine Gun Kelly or anybody else because they were drunk, but it was because of territory and the money.
Absolutely. It's always about money. We see the same sort of things with legitimate businesses. Some of these legitimate businesses engage in some ruthless practices. Go to Wall Street. We see a lot of sort of ruthless things that happens, but we don't see them carrying machine guns because they fight in different ways, but it's equally ruthless.
What about something that's going on today, and I'm not sure how long it's been going on, Carl, but suddenly it's not heroin, it's not coke, it's prescription drugs. It's something that we have in our medicine cabinet.
Yeah, like you said, you're not sure how it's been going. First of all, we have to be clear about prescription medication. If people are abusing drugs, you have a choice between drugs that people buy on the street or prescription drugs. I would far rather them buy or abuse prescription meds because we know what's in prescription medications. But I know recently it's received a lot of attention in the public. Most of that attention is stupid, the attention, because people's focus are not really on what the problem should be. So prescription opioids, like prescription pain pills, people say more people are dying because of these prescription pain pills. People are dying because, for example, with pain pills, not because of the pain pills alone. That's a rare sort of event. They die because they combine them with things like alcohol or other sedatives when they should be told, don't combine it with another sedative. That's one. Another reason, and this is what I find really disturbing, when we think about prescription pain pills, they contain things like acetaminophen and an opiate. Acetaminophen, 325 milligrams or 500 milligrams. And the opiate is like 5 milligrams or 10. So a low dose of an opiate. Sometimes if people are getting high and they were seeking the opiate, they still have to take all of that acetaminophen.
And that's more dangerous.
Acetaminophen is the number one reason for liver toxicity in the world. And so it's like, so you ask, well, why is there so much acetaminophen in these medications? Well, sometimes people will say, well, it's an additional pain reliever. I don't think that's the major reason. The major reason is to discourage people from abusing the low dose of opiate. So it would be like saying, we don't want you to speed in your car. So whenever you drive past 55, your tires will blow out. And that's what is essentially happening. I think that's where this conversation should be. Not on our sort of concern about, oh, opioid prescription abuse. That's not where the concern should be, because we at least know what are in those medications as opposed to street medications.
What about opiates where they have an extended release?
Opiates that have an extended release, that's fine as long as people are taught how to use these things and they don't combine them with other sedatives. I mean, these things we know quite a bit about, that we don't need to have all of these problems. But the problem is that we have just not been honest and teach people and haven't taught people how to use these things safely.
Interesting, Carl, in your book on page 13, you talk about, we're just talking about, and you say, but more than 75% of drug users, whether they use alcohol, prescription medications, or illegal drugs, do not have this problem.
That's right. The vast majority of people who use these drugs are not addicted. They don't have a problem. They go to work. They pay their taxes. They're responsible people. They take care of their kids. The last three occupants of the White House, they all used illegal drugs. They all rose to the highest power in the land. They're all people who we would be proud to call children of our own. And that's the typical drug user. But that's not the typical picture that the public gets. The public gets Breaking Bad or some sort of character of a drug user, because that's a lot more sexy and it's a lot more drama, but that's not reality.
So let's talk about addiction, because people don't like that word. And what is the difference between addiction and tolerance?
Well, let's just say what's the difference. The thing that people have to be careful about is that they shouldn't conflate terms like drug user and drug addict. So a drug user is someone who goes to work, like me. I use alcohol. I certainly have taken sleeping pills. I certainly have taken stimulants, all of those kinds of things. I'm a drug user. But I pay my taxes. I take care of my kids. That's the majority of drug users. When we think of somebody like, if we think about drug addict, those are people who have social dysfunctions, occupational dysfunctions. They have disruptions in their ability to work, go to school, take care of their family. They have had several unsuccessful attempts to cut down or stop their drug use. They use, despite the fact that they have knowledge that the drug is interfering with their psychological functioning, their physical functioning. They might have tolerance or they may not have tolerance. They may have withdrawal symptoms or they may not have withdrawal symptoms. So there's a list of symptoms that people have to meet in order to be classified as a drug addict.
Now, at the end of your book, you talk about decriminalization versus legalization and what Portugal did in 2001.
Yeah, I talk, this is an alternative. This is after people have read the book, so they will have some knowledge about what we should do. In this country, every year, we arrest 1.5 million people for drugs. 80% of those people are for simple drug possession. The number one reason we arrest people are for drugs. We are spending $26 billion a year in our sort of fight for against drugs. And most of the people who we're arresting are black and brown. So we use our drug policy or enforcement in a racially discriminatory manner. When I look at all of this sort of thing, it decreases the likelihood that black and brown people will be contributors to this society, that they will be able to take care of their families. When I think of all of these kinds of things, the most rational thing to do is to do like what Portugal did. You don't have to legalize drugs. You can just treat drugs in the same way we treat traffic violations. If you get caught, you get a fine, maybe, or a warning, but you don't get a criminal record. We won't retard your ability to pay taxes and get a job. It just seems rational to me.
Carl, thank you very much for being with us here today. We've been visiting with Dr. Carl Hart. Dr. Hart is the author of High Price, A Neuroscientist's Journey of Self-Discovery that Challenges Everything You Know About Drugs and Society. And Carl, I assume that this is available on Amazon.com.
But they should support their local bookstores.
And do you have a website too?
I have a website. The website is drcarlhart.com.
Well, thank you very much for being with us here today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.